Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, news outlets are proliferating in the digital age, but many are undermining the public trust in local news by reporting disinformation disguised as mainstream journalism. And we're just over a week into spring. However, it's not too early to pick up the battle against the spotted lanternfly. But to begin, we're starting to get an idea of what the new school year in September might look like, even as it's all but certain COVID will remain a presence in this country. The number of new cases in New Jersey has been increasing lately, but at the same time, vaccine supply and eligibility are expected to ramp up. Governor Murphy indicated Wednesday that public school kids would return to brick and mortar classrooms full time in the fall, and that districts will not be allowed to offer the option of virtual learning. It was a brief statement without much elaboration, but one which raises some questions. NJ Advance Media's Matt Arco has been following this story and joins us now to tell us more. Welcome back, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Mary.
Sure. So Governor Murphy seemed pretty firm in that he's expecting schools across the state to return for in-person learning for the start of the new year. Matt, did Murphy address the issue of those parents who might be concerned about a continued presence of COVID-19 in the community and who might prefer keeping a virtual option in place?
Yeah, I'd say other than the fact that I asked him this question about whether parents would have the option, whether or not to return to in-person learning, and he actually cut me off and said unequivocally, no, he expects in-person learning. But he did have the caveat that he said, quote, obviously, if the world goes sideways, we have to reassess that, end quote. So he's leaving the door open to the fact that if we have a much different picture than what we expect to have coming September, that he would reverse his decision. But he's very adamant about where he wants, he's always been pro in-person learning.
Yeah.
And he's just being very bullish on the fact that the amount of vaccines and people getting vaccinated in the coming months will just be on the rise and we'll be in the position to send people to school. So, and the concerns of parents now will be alleviated.
Also, though, a lot of money has been spent by districts to set up virtual technology, to make sure kids have laptops, to train teachers in this. Have we heard at all from the governor about this angle?
No, but it's a good question, because when he makes that statement, school districts now, they have to, they're in the planning stages for next season, for next school year. So, you know, they have to grapple with what their budgets are going to be and think long term. But again, the governor is signaling, hey, folks, you're on notice that as things go, plan to be in person.
Matt, what sort of reaction have you been getting to your reporting on this?
I could say immediately that I've heard from a lot of parents that didn't see this as welcome news. The overarching sense seemed to be that, hey, we don't feel like we're returning to normal just yet. We're not doing things like dining out. I'm not comfortable as a parent without having this option for my child, whether it be that child has some sort of pre-existing condition that could make them more susceptible to having serious side effects from COVID, or the parents themselves. But again, this is all predicated on people reacting to where we are right now, which isn't a very rosy picture. However, the expectation is, you know, this week alone, we have 500,000 vaccine doses coming to the state.
Yeah.
And the state is, you know, the governor and health officials say they're still on mark to vaccinate 4.7 million people in New Jersey by the end of May. So we can be in a much different picture come May, June, July, that, you know, by the time September rolls around, you know, these parents are saying that we haven't returned to normal. They could have different opinions.
Okay. Let's take a look at the CDC guidelines for classroom settings. They've relaxed a bit recently. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So the biggest thing that's been relaxed is that the CDC has said that instead of a 6-foot buffer between desks, students can have a 3-foot buffer. And what health officials in New Jersey said last year, that depending on the current caseload in each quadrant in the state, they're breaking it down by 6 different quadrants in terms of the level of COVID exposure, that if you reach a certain benchmark in lower cases, that they, in those areas, they're recommending the 3-foot buffer. But in places where outbreaks numbers are still high, they're sticking with the 6-foot.
And we can expect plastic dividers, mask wearing, other social distancing guidelines to continue.
Of course, everything that's still in place, yes.
Yeah. So in the year, Matt, since the pandemic began, about how many outbreaks have we seen in New Jersey's schools, and how many cases among the school population?
So what the state has reported, that it's a little less than 1,000 documented cases of in-school transmission. The governor has said repeatedly that school is safer than many other places. Again, a little under 1,000. When I see that number, you know, I would think the number is actually a little bit larger. What we know is that contact tracing has really it hasn't been successful in New Jersey. Folks don't work with contact tracers. If I had to guess, I would say that the number is larger than that. But, you know, overall, when you're talking about New Jersey's overall numbers, health officials continue to say that they've been able to make school, more safe than not. But look, that being said, there's only about 97,000 students that are doing all in person at the moment, with 143 school districts, and there's 300,000 students who are doing all remote. So It's under 1,000 cases in where hundreds of thousands of students aren't even doing in person at all.
And just as an aside here, contact tracing, you know, it's interesting. We haven't heard about that for a while. Has that effort failed, do you think?
I think health officials would say it would. I mean, we haven't heard it from a while. The last time that we heard about it was months ago, when health officials were pleading with people to work with contact tracers. And to my memory, the best that I can remember, I think it was like 70% of folks that were being contacted weren't working with contact tracers. It could have even been higher than that. So it's that is being seen as a failure. I wouldn't say because the state was unable to roll it out successfully and get enough contact tracers in place. If health officials are to be trusted here, it's just that people just don't want to work with them.
Yeah, it's kind of a big experiment, actually. I mean, none of us knew quite what to do when this all started happening, the pandemic back in March. So, okay. So again, as you mentioned earlier, the number of COVID cases in New Jersey has been climbing back up again. Why is this, Matt? What are the experts saying?
The best that we're getting from health officials is that these new variants are we know, way more contagious, and they are very much in New Jersey. And now the health officials have established a few hundred cases of these new variants, but they also haven't been able to tell us exactly how much testing they're doing for these new variants. And from remarks of health officials during these briefings, I've gleaned that it's not an overwhelming majority of every positive PCR test they're testing for these new variants. So my guess, and the governor has all but said this, that he expects there's a lot more of these new variants in our region than we're even reporting. Hmm. And anytime a new variant crops up, maybe in New York, the governor has been unequivocal saying, look, if it's in New York, it's here. And that's
sure
really been the case.
Yeah. Hey.
Other than that, if people are letting their hair down, that would just be anecdotal. So I can't say that's the case, but having, you know, being out and about now, like many people are, it does look like there's a sizable amount of people that maybe are in the sort of I'm over it period. There could be a level of that, too.
Yeah. Is the state saying whether there is any one variant that is more prominent than the others?
The UK variant is the overwhelming, more prominent variant in New Jersey. And that's something to watch, because in the UK, that is now the most dominant COVID variant in new positive tests. And it's possible, you know, we asked last week, at what point will that be the most dominant variant? And it sounds, and we didn't get a clear answer, but it sounds like sooner than later, it could be the most predominant.
At ARCO, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned the big expansion in vaccine eligibility, which is underway. Tell us now who is moving into eligibility, some of the groups which are now able to receive the vaccine.
Sure. Actually, beginning today, people in food production and agriculture, certain folks in social services, support staff, it just opened up to them today. And then the bigger news is, in a week, it's people 55 and older, people with chronic, 16 to 60 or to 54 with chronic health issues, developmental health issues. Chronic health is already accepted as a way to get the vaccine. So those are the two big ones. And then, you know, the governor has said that we're on track, that by May 1, he hopes to, or he expects to be able to comply with what President Joe Biden said, which was everybody should be eligible for a vaccine. So the governor has said we're still on track, that by May 1, he expects that everybody will be able to, will at least be able to make an appointment.
And this will be helped along by a huge federally run center, which is opening up in Newark, apparently able to vaccinate thousands every day.
Yes, and that is new doses that are coming in directly from the feds, not part of, you know, when I say that when a health official said that the state should get 500,000 doses this week, the vaccines that are coming to that facility in Newark will be on top of that, too.
Matt, you recently reported on the concept of a vaccine passport. Tell us what this is, and does it seem as if the state of New Jersey might embrace it?
Well, it's a little hazy, actually, because there's not a lot of details, and there was a little bit of a controversy around the governor because he was asked during a TV appearance whether he would embrace sort of the idea of a passport, which would be, you know, I guess conceptually we're talking about people that take their CDC cards and then it's converted into something else, because I think there's a lot of issues about the CDC cards being able to be people could just forge them, basically.
Sure.
But there would be some sort of passport that would say, hey, make it eligible for you to go to a sporting event or do something else under the new normal. And the governor said kind of on the fly, he was asked about that. He said, yeah, okay, you know, we'll listen to what the CDC says and we'll investigate it also ourselves. But, yeah, I guess that's something that that I'd be open to. And some Republicans in the state, particularly, you know, it's an election year this year in New Jersey, so the Republicans running against the governor sort of sees that as an opportunity to say, oh, the governor's going to put one group ahead of the other. And the governor, you know, to his credit, clarified a few times, like, look, folks, this is just something I said I would be open to. But we're, his remarks has always been prefaced with, we're going to do with what the CDC says. So as far as any passport in New Jersey, there's really no details, because it was just sort of a hypothetical. Is it something you think is a good idea? Okay, maybe we'll take it under consideration.
Okay. So again, we're looking forward to the probability that schools will open full time in brick and mortar classrooms in the fall in New Jersey. And briefly, we've got about a half minute, Matt. You know, the state's economy is slowly reopening. Indoor capacity, restaurants, bars, casinos, et cetera, has been at, what, 50% for nearly 2 weeks?
Yes, it's that's something that the governor has loosened restrictions on within the past couple of weeks. Even as you said earlier, I mean, numbers are going up in Philadelphia, numbers are going up in Jersey. And, you know, this week will really tell us whether New Jersey is going up or if we've sort of plateaued now at these sort of 4,000 new positive tests every day. We'll know within the next couple of days whether we're plateaued or whether we're going to see a rise.
Okay,
rise.
And we will be following that story. Matt Arko, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
Matt is a reporter for the Star Ledger and New Jersey Advance Media. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. More to come. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Welcome back. Just a few decades ago, most Americans got their news from the daily paper and the big three network evening broadcasts. Today, of course, we can access information any time of the day or night from a dizzying array of online sources. But with a proliferation of sites calling themselves news, how do we know which offer accurate, objective journalism or something more closely resembling partisan propaganda, skillfully disguised as legitimate reporting? It's not always easy to tell the difference. A new report from the media watchdog company NewsGuard has found that a majority of news outlets in Pennsylvania are highly credible sources of information, but a full 30% are not and are instead deeply partisan. So what's a consumer to do? How do we wade through the information that's out there to get to the reporting that will leave us well-informed, especially when it comes to local news? Matt Skibinski is the general manager of NewsGuard and author of the Pennsylvania News Trust Report, and he's with us now on the Regional Roundup. Good of you to join us, Matt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This is eye-opening stuff, especially coming on the heels of a year like 2020, which felt at times like a constant battle against disinformation. So NewsGuard reviewed 160 local news organizations in Pennsylvania. 70% were found to be highly credible. A full 30% were not. What was your reaction to the finding of your organization?
So it's funny, you know, NewsGuard, we rate and review news organizations all over the country, not just in Pennsylvania. We've rated thousands of news outlets. We use the same 9 basic apolitical journalistic criteria for every rating we do. And the interesting thing is that in terms of, you know, the percentage, the numbers in Pennsylvania quite closely match what we see nationwide and actually even in other countries. We're also in a few countries in Europe. So I wasn't, you know, unfortunately, as someone who is constantly looking at the credibility of news organizations, wasn't surprised to see that number. I think the good news that we saw was that, you know, the kind of legitimate news outlets in Pennsylvania are highly credible. The average score out of 100 points in our trust ratings for the group that we assessed was 93.4, which is quite high. Means, you know, most of those sites adhere, you know, quite strongly to journalistic practices. And the 30% we saw was mostly, you know, sites that have partisan funding and partisan agendas that tend to exist in a lot of places in the country.
Well, and that was the next question. Did you find a majority of the misinformation reported in less credible sites involved a political slant?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, the context for this is that, you know, Americans' trust in the media and news media in general has been falling for years. I think the most recent study I saw about this was from about a year ago and from Gallup, and said that about almost 40% of Americans say they don't trust national news media. But in contrast, 85% of Americans say they do trust local news.
Interesting.
And so on the one hand, this is really great. It means people have still have trust in their local journalistic outlets, and I think for good reason. But that's also sort of a resource that bad actors can exploit, is our trust in local news, and they're starting to do that.
Sure. Matt Skibinski, how do these less credible sites resemble, you know, credible news websites, and what do they use to draw the viewer in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, think about the way that most people encounter news nowadays. It's not in the context of, you know, a printed publication where there's a big masthead on the top that says, you know, this is the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's in a Facebook feed, a search result, or somewhere where, you know, all news looks kind of the same. It's a headline with some words, a blurb below it. And so, you know, when you click through on those headlines, if what you see looks like a legitimate news organization, you know, it's completely possible that a person, you know, could assume that some of these sites that are really intended for partisan purposes are just like a local newspaper. So if you, in Philadelphia, for example, you know, you might see a link to phillytrib.com and click through, and it's a website that says the Philadelphia Tribune, and it has news headlines and some sports scores and some weather, and it just looks like a local newspaper. And you might see another headline for something called phillyleader.com, and you click through, and it's some sports scores and some local news and some weather. And, you know, you might assume they're the same. Philly Trib is, you know, been publishing since 1884. It's the longest continuously publishing newspaper serving the African American community. Philly Leader, on the other hand, is owned by a group that operates 1,300 local websites across the country. It's owned by a organization that has sort of a partisan purpose behind it. It has had a history of publishing highly partisan content around elections in districts that are competitive, and even publishing content that, you know, for example, when the CEO was lobbying on behalf of U.S.-based hotel owners, all of the websites were promoting content opposing COVID restrictions affecting hotels. There's all these conflicts of interest, and to a reader, it's not clear that there's any difference between those two sites when, in fact, there's a huge difference.
So there are no glaring signs that jump out at viewers that might jump out?
Typically not, you know, especially if what you click through is a page with an article, and you know it looks a lot like a newspaper website, and there are links to other articles that, you know, sometimes they're even these sites will even, you know, plagiarize stories from legitimate news organizations to put them kind of as window dressing. So it looks like you're on a legitimate news site, but you know, then they're either promoting on Facebook the stories that are false or that are highly partisan. There are ways users can tell if you're more savvy. You know, you might click around the site and start to notice some things that are a little bit off. Like there's no clear, you know, bylines on stories that say who produced the content. Maybe you can't find any information about ownership. And that's a lot of what we look at when we're evaluating a site. You know, we start from the assumption that every site is credible, and then we look for, are they adhering to basic standards of credibility or basic standards of transparency? And if, as you start to look at those, you can sort of understand the differences. But, you know, most readers are not doing that every time they click a link. They're just reacting to it and moving on with their day.
So the reader has to do a little work. What is at stake, Matt Skibinski, you know, with local news reporting if trust in its accuracy erodes? What are the consequences?
Well, the biggest consequence is that, you know, local news, really since America began as a nation, local news has been a big part of the backbone of our democratic process. So, you know, people trust their local news outlets. Their local news outlets, you know, tend to report on matters of import to people who live in that area. And that helps them decide everything from, you know, who to vote for, to what to do with their time, to how to spend their money, where to live. And so, you know, if you erode trust in local news, what's really going to happen is people will stop having this sort of trusted source of truth to go back to make decisions. And that can be, you can imagine all of the ways that can be really damaging for democracy. Political implications are probably the most glaring, which is, you know, if you see a local headline and you either can't trust it or don't trust it because you've seen all these other bad actors, you know, popping up. How are voters to make an informed decision about who to vote for or, yeah, you know, which candidate best represents their interests if they don't have accurate information about what's happening in the world?
And to be clear, both major parties take part in publishing so-called news that's skewed politically, correct?
Absolutely. So, you know, the example I mentioned earlier, Metric Media, is a kind of right-leaning organization, but we also name in our report, including in Pennsylvania, sites run by another group called Acronym, which is, you know, Democratic-leaning. It's kind of explicitly a political advocacy organization. It operates a political action committee and, you know, sort of brags on its website that it uses these local targeted media strategies to drive voters to vote for Democratic candidates. And they operate in almost all of the swing states, I think, operate websites like the one that they have in Pennsylvania, which most of the time is publishing accurate content. It's not like it's everything they publish is made up, but it certainly has a strong partisan bent. And especially when it gets close to an election, they'll use that partisan content, promote it on Facebook or other platforms, and use that to drive voters, you know, decision making at the polls.
Got it. You know, interestingly, among the things that can draw a reader in are the names of these publications, which can inspire trustworthiness. Something, say, you know, the Bucks County News or, you know, Keystone Today, which comes from Acronym, correct?
Right.
Guessing this is on purpose?
Absolutely. So what they're really doing is latching on to that trust that people have in local news and exploiting it, and at the same time undermining it. Because if you hear, you know, if you generally trust local newspapers or local news outlets, and you see something called Lehigh Times, you know, and you see another site called Lehigh Valley Live, you're going to assume that they're equal in terms of their publishing practices, their transparency, their hopeful lack of partisanship. But, you know, that's another example. Lehigh Times is part of Metric Media's network, and Lehigh Valley Live is a, you know, newspaper that's been publishing since, I think, the late 1800s as well. So, you know, that's really what they're, that's an intentional strategy to kind of dig in and use trust people have in local news as a resource to get them to trust this partisan content.
Matt Skibinski, let's talk about the criteria NewsGuard uses to determine credibility, which also might help readers make decisions when it comes to what they're consuming. Number one, a publication does not repeatedly publish false content. Well, the reader has to recognize what the false content is, correct?
That's right. And so, you know, to understand, to really understand a site's record of accuracy requires reviewing, you know, some of their past content. You know, one of the things we do at NewsGuard, we have this team of journalists who assesses each site that we review, and we actually make the results of our rating process available as a browser extension and an app that you can download that displays our rating and our explanation for the rating right next to a link on Facebook or Google. So, you know, in that case, if you have NewsGuard installed, we've sort of done that work for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the hardest of the criteria for sort of an average reader to evaluate, because it does require doing a bit of research on the site and clicking through some of the past content and really getting a sense for what they do. You know, some of the other criteria we use, I think any reader can make some sort of evaluation and learn how to make these evaluations. So, for example, you know, we look at, does the site separate news and opinion in a responsible way?
Ah, mm-hmm. Let me just jump in there for a moment. It is seemingly so easy these days, Matt, to cross that line. A little bit of journalism 101. The difference between news and opinion is what?
Well, news is trying to report accurate information without a point of view. Of course, all journalism has, you know, some biases because of the people who are producing it and their worldview, but journalists are trained to minimize the amount of bias and certainly to remove overt opinions from their news reporting. Whereas an opinion article, you know, is free to advocate for a certain viewpoint or, you know, provide commentary that's more judgmental on the events of the day. And, you know, typically in newspapers, you know, and other kind of traditional news outlets, the news section was very clearly labeled as news, and the opinion section was very clearly labeled as opinion. And online, there's a much more blurred line between those two things.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, what we're reading can make us feel good about ourselves and validate our opinion. Let's get to the echo chamber for a moment. Christina Christofik, who's managing editor at the Keystone, which again is associated with Acronym, she told Spotlight PA, "I think a lot of people feel traditional media, whether their local newspaper or local TV station, doesn't serve them and doesn't provide the information they want, and so they go looking for outlets that do." You know, being in an echo chamber might feel good and can be validating, but is it good for maintaining a strong democracy?
Well, one interesting thing that, you know, we've wrestled a lot with the question of what about a news site that has an overt, overall opinion or point of view? And there's a long history of opinion journalism that's been around, you know, for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
What we think is important at NewsGuard is that if a site has a point of view and if it has a partisan or political purpose, it should just make that extremely clear to readers, because what you don't want is readers to think they're reading news that's intended to be fair and as objective as possible, but is actually, you know, trying to manipulate them in some way or trying to advance a viewpoint. And so, you know, I think readers should be able to choose their media diet. I think readers who want to be well-informed will choose a little bit of opinion and a lot of factual information and then form some of their own judgments, having heard kind of all the sides of an argument and all the perspectives about an issue. But they can't do that if they think that they're reading kind of straight up news and they're reading something that's slanted toward one side or the other.
We have a comment from Rick. "The First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech. That speech doesn't have to be true. It's on us as readers to do the work to figure it out." Guessing you're not going to disagree there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the big philosophies that we use at NewsGuard is we don't block anything. We don't try to censor anything. We don't, in any way prevent people from publishing information. What we try to do is provide readers with context they need to understand whether or not they should trust a source that they encounter as they're browsing news online. And so, you know, in fact, we're sort of protected by the First Amendment ourselves. We're journalists, too, at NewsGuard, and the journalism we choose to do is reporting on the credibility of outlets that you'll encounter. I do think, you know, there are points where speech can become so harmful that it is, you know, it can be restricted by law. For example, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. And so, you know, there are cases where outlets will sort of cross some legal lines. And we actually, if a site has been, you know, sued successfully for libel or some other kind of legal action against it, we'll include that in our, you know, assessment of the site so that readers can know, at least know that there's a history of action against the site.
You know, more than ever, it seems as if, you know, credible journalism outlets are up against a well-funded tsunami of misinformation online. What would you like to see from, you know, the major social media platforms like Facebook?
Yeah, so I think for the social media platforms, search engines, anyone that hosts content from news organizations in a feed, you know, we strongly feel that what's missing almost all the time is context. So readers see a headline, they may not even realize what source it is, and they see a little blurb and it all looks the same in a news feed, whether it's, you know, the Philadelphia Inquirer or the National Inquirer. And so, you know, what we think is that social media platforms, search engines, et cetera, should give readers context on what is this source and what is its record of accuracy and how transparent is it, who owns it, you know, anything that might be relevant for them to understand, should I trust this source? And, you know, if they did that, even if readers encountered misinformation in their feed, they'd be able to understand it and make judgments about whether or not to trust it.
All right. We'll wrap up on a quick note from Dave. He says, I'm a journalist, and I feel like there's an important point that needs to be made about readers who think they're getting objective news but are not, because there are so many lines that don't get crossed by objective journalism. I feel better writing so people know my point of view when you read my articles. Matt Skibinski, thank you very much for joining us for the Regional Roundup. Important information, and again, you know, readers can check out the NewsGuard credibility rating, as you mentioned earlier. So great to have you with us.
Thank you.
All right. Stay with us as the Regional Roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The weather's been pretty good for early spring cleanup in the garden. And to round out the hour, we are going to add another chore to the list. Gardening experts say it's an ideal time to hunt for and remove the grayish, cracked egg masses of the spotted lanternfly, which are often found attached to trees, fence posts, decks, awnings, and the list goes on. The eggs begin to hatch in mid-late April or May, and then, as many homeowners and businesses well know, the battle begins to contain the surging population of nymphs and later adult lanternflies. The invasive plant hopper is native to Asia and was first spotted in Berks County in 2014. And since then, the spotted lanternfly has spread to more than half of Pennsylvania's counties, as well as South Jersey and Delaware, causing tens of millions of dollars in damage to various crops. So, what are the emerging technologies to fight this pest, and are we gaining any ground in trying to get ahead of it? Any questions? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Emily Swackhammer is horticulture educator with the Penn State Extension, and she joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Good to have you back with us, Emily.
Good morning.
Well, for many of us, getting back out into the garden is a joy and a pleasure, but there's serious business to attend to. What are we talking about? Maybe, a month or maybe less before we see the spotted lanternfly population begin to hatch?
Yeah, the first lanternfly eggs hatched in the Philadelphia area last year in the middle of April.
Okay.
So most of them will hatch in May. You have some time. But as you were saying, getting out there and destroying the egg masses is a really good thing to do right now.
So they seem to be camouflaged somewhat. In looking at pictures, they're kind of, again, they're grayish white and maybe look kind of mud-like. Are they tough to spot for the gardener who's keeping an eye out?
I think once you've seen a few of them, they're not hard to tell apart from other things. But we do have people asking about things like lichens on trees that are really harmless, little associations between fungi and algae. There are other insects' eggs out there, so it's really good to learn how to identify them. You don't want to destroy eggs of beneficial insects.
And we could put a picture up, on our social media page when we're finished with the show so people can, be clear on that. How many lantern flies, Emily, can one mass produce?
Yeah, so they vary pretty widely, but on average, it's about 35 eggs per egg mass. We've found egg masses all the way up to like 90 eggs in an egg mass. But the females often choose one area that they really like to lay eggs on. So you often find them in groups.
What do we do when we see an egg mass? And are they hard to remove?
Yeah, so the first thing is don't get up on ladders. We don't want anybody having a ladder accident. And okay. Really, most of the eggs are going to be up high in the canopy of trees, so you can't reach all of them. But the ones that you can reach, they can be on tree trunks, they can be under rocks, they can be under like picnic tables, they might be on rusty metal. You really have to look around on everything and especially check those protected areas. So when you find them, you can destroy them pretty easily just by smashing them. Pick up a rock or a stick or something and you can smash them. And when you do that, the innards kind of pop out and you see that. So you know you're killing them.
Okay, wear gloves.
it's kind of icky. But you can also scrape them into a container and then put some rubbing alcohol in that container. And we often use a plastic bag. And then you can just tie that plastic bag off and put that in the trash. And that will kill the eggs.
Well, we've got an email from Jessica who says, I lead a Girl Scout troop in Lancaster County who made lanternfly egg sac removal kits as their bronze award project. The 4th and 5th grade Girl Scouts made over 200 kits that have reused plastic gift cards with instructions attached on how hikers and park visitors can use that card to scrape egg sacs off the tree. That's a great idea.
That is a great idea. And I'm aware of other community efforts going on to scrape and destroy egg masses. So it's happening even, with COVID, people are social distancing, but still out there trying to protect parks and things like that.
Well, remind us of the damage the spotted lanternfly can do to parks, to trees, to crops. What does it do to plants?
So the main concern is grapes. A lot of acreage of grapes in Pennsylvania have been killed as a result of spotted lanternfly feeding on them. So that's our main concern. We are still learning about other trees. We know spotted lanternfly can kill tree of heaven, and that is an invasive tree that they really, really like. It's considered a weed tree, so nobody's too upset that they're killing tree of heaven. Although some people have tree of heaven as an ornamental, like shade tree, in their yard. And if you're in that situation, then it would be upsetting. We have not seen spotted lanternfly kill any ornamental landscape trees.
But they can weaken trees, though. Even if they don't kill them, they can weaken them. Is that true? Nope. Do we have Emily? I think we might have lost the connection. Okay, we're going to work to get Emily Swackhammer of the Penn State Extension back with us here on the Regional Roundup. We are talking about the spotted lanternfly, and as many of us who live in the Philly area well know, this creature just seems to be overwhelming at a certain point in late spring and summer. It is invasive, and it can destroy crops and also weaken different plants and trees. And we're talking about what to do right now at the end of March, as early spring is just getting underway and ahead of when the egg masses hatch in mid-April and maybe over into early May. The hunt for the egg masses, trying to get ahead of the spotted lanternfly. And I am told that we have Emily back with us right now. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No, that's quite all right. So I think we were talking about how, how it affects different crops and trees, but it destroys particularly grape crops, but can it weaken other trees?
Right.
I mean, you don't want it in the garden, period, correct?
Yeah, we have seen it kill the tree of heaven, which is an invasive tree. It's considered a weed. And most people don't care much about them. There are some people that have that as an ornamental or shade tree in their yard. And in that case, you would care. But we have not seen spotted lanternfly kill landscape trees. So people need to know that they don't have to treat every tree in their yard. And we're trying now to, through our research, measure the health effects of the feeding on these ornamental trees. As our listeners know, sometimes you see thousands of lanternfly feeding on, like, maple trees.
They're overwhelming. Yeah.
They are. And some of the research has shown that that feeding can reduce the photosynthetic capability of the tree. And, you know, that has to have some sort of health effects. But they're not killing healthy landscape trees. So people need to kind of temper their expectations and not be as afraid of it as, you know, like some of these. There unfortunately have been companies that have been a little predatory in their practices of trying to get people to buy their services.
Okay.
You know, we have a lot of good companies that are selling very appropriate practices, but I have seen some of that going on.
Okay, so we have to watch for that, yeah.
Yeah, you need to have realistic expectations. You can treat every tree on your property, and you won't prevent them from coming back onto your property. So we're not suggesting that you do that. We're trying to get people to use safer practices, hopefully use the least amount of pesticides that you need to make it tolerable for your situation. Now, that's different if you're outside of the area where they are already established. And we have Ocean County in New Jersey, Cape May County, Sussex County in Delaware. They're not established in those counties yet. So if you find them there, we'll probably recommend that you go after them with more aggressive practices to control them.
Let's talk about natural predators. A citizen science study team, I think it was out of Penn State, has been delving into this. And the potential conclusion is that more of us might want to invest in praying mantises and even chickens. Have you heard anything about this? How about encouraging natural predators?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, we definitely want to encourage natural predators. We know that spiders, praying mantids, some birds will feed on them. And you know, they're good creatures. We want to encourage them for not just spotted lanternfly reasons, but just in general. But at the moment, we don't have any research to show that those creatures are having a big impact on the spotted lanternfly population. So we're not recommending that people invest money in purchasing them. In general, if you buy things like praying mantids, they're probably already there in your landscape. And, you know, it's just not an economically satisfying investment to get the results that you were hoping for.
In Asia, the spotted lanternfly's natural enemies include a parasitic wasp. Is there talk of importing some of the lanternfly's enemies? And does this potentially open a different Pandora's box?
Absolutely. There is talk of that, and there are some researchers working very hard on that. These natural predators, or they're actually parasitic wasps, they're very tiny. So if you saw one of them, you'd hardly even notice it was there. But we can't just bring things from other continents to our country and release them without doing all sorts of investigative research to make sure that they're not going to have negative impacts on the natural populations of insects that are here, our native insects. So the researchers that are doing that work, you can imagine how detailed this work is. They have to imagine in their mind all of the different things, insects that could be affected.
Sure.
Figure out a way to do those tests in a lab, in a quarantine lab. And, you know, raising all of these insects kind of in those artificial environments is not easy. And then the timing of the life cycles and, you know, there's just so much to it. So if that's ever a possibility, they say it's usually like a 10-year process or longer. So we're not there yet. And at the moment, there's really none of those parasites on the horizon that are showing great promise.
We have a question from James who asks, should we be killing all lanternflies every time we see them. And this kind of goes along to along with another question. Emily, at some point, are we going to just have to live with some level of spotted lanternfly population?
Yeah, we will, and I think we already are. The people that have been dealing with them since 2014, 2015, you know, have realized this. And we do want to try to control the population, suppress the population, and really maybe the more important thing is don't move them to new areas. There's been a lot of effort in that regard, and we believe that the spread of this insect would have been much further, much faster, if we hadn't been doing so much to try to suppress it all along.
So should we kill one every time we see one?
If you can, go ahead. You know, but please don't do things that are putting you like in financial jeopardy. Please don't use unsafe pesticide practices. You know, use good common sense. Now, if you're outside of the quarantine area, that's different. If you're outside, say you're in Ocean County, New Jersey, and you find some, you need to alert the Department of Agriculture, and, you know, they'll tell you what needs to be done. So within the quarantine area, though, suppress them, don't move them around, educate other people about safe practices, and we do the best we can.
Is the spread slowing at all?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think we really have a way to measure that. You know, it hasn't gotten super far as far as, you know, into the middle of the country. We certainly don't want to see it establishing on the West Coast. But we really don't have any way to measure what would have happened if we weren't trying to control it. So we're still optimistic, and people are still being as careful as they can be. Businesses are getting their permits. They're inspecting things before they're being shipped. The Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture is working with the train lines, major transportation corridors. They're starting to do bigger scale treatments of insecticides along those corridors. So the fight continues.
We have an email from Dave who says, I pay my kids bounties for each egg mass and nymphs. Bounties are not paid for adult lanternflies, and the kids love it. So
I know of other people that are doing that. And, you know, it's a great chance to teach kids about invasive insects and hopefully that there are also good insects. So, you know, it's a good chance to have a biology science lesson with the kids and keep them busy at the same time.
We're talking about, you know, safer insecticide methods. Sticky bands that go around trees, how effective are these, again, Emily? And do we risk casualties among beneficial insects with this method?
Yes, we absolutely do. The sticky bands, which were popular, you know, in the past, they can catch a lot of lanternfly. The lanternfly fall out of the trees. They go back to the trunks. They crawl up. And then as they pass that band, they stick to it. But we know that we're catching other insects, spiders, and in some cases, you know, really unfortunately, some wildlife. And nobody wants that to happen. So if you're planning on using sticky bands, you have to put a guard over it. Tie it off at the top, make it open at the bottom so that the spotted lanternfly can crawl up, but birds can't get against that sticky band.
Yeah. So, and again, as we get to the top of the hour, final advice for listeners. It's a great time to get out there and hunt for egg masses. What else can we do to try to at least lessen the population of the spotted lanternfly?
Yeah. Check out circle traps. We're shifting away from sticky bands to using a totally mechanical trap that really doesn't have the wildlife problems that sticky bands have. We have an article on our website that's a pictorial demonstration of how you can build them yourself very inexpensively. I'm hoping we see more circle traps out there this year.
All right, Emily Swackhammer, thanks again, and I'm sure we will be in touch with you on this subject down the road. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All thanks right. for having me.
Emily Swackhammer is a horticulture educator with the Penn State Extension. Don't forget, our rebroadcast airs at 11 tonight on WHYY. We're on social media, too, at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer is John Ahrens, with help today from Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us, and be well.